down at the local mill. Work dried up, not a mill is ill. I can't pay my bills. Repo man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, two kids, a car, and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the May 28th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air on WEFT, Champaign, 90.1 FM, and streaming on the World Wide Web at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinion of WEFT's management, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support Community Radio in East Central Illinois.
All right, thanks, Tom. I'm your host, Bob Polesny, here today along with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week from his book Cries for Justice is entitled Labor Builds Dreams. Also here with us today is Jason Kozlowski, labor historian. He'll have some news reports and some commentary for us today. And now here's Tom to kick off this week's labor interest news.
GE Capital is planning to nearly double the number of its employees in Chicago to more than 2,000. Officials with the financial services arm of General Electric joined Mayor Rahm Emanuel at a news conference last Monday to report that 500 of those new jobs, skilled commercial, technical, and regulatory positions, will be added within the next year. The other 500 jobs will come over the next few years. The company is also looking for a new office in Chicago to accommodate the workforce. During his mayoral campaign, Emanuel boasted of his relationships with business and government leaders from his time as an Illinois congressman and when he was President Obama's chief of staff. Monday's news conference served as a reminder of his national stature as well as, according to the Associated Press, a pep rally for Chicago. Emanuel, who is trying to attract more businesses to the nation's third largest city to help overcome its budget shortfall, downplayed the effect of his relationship with GEO's CEO, Jeff Immelt, may have had on the company's decision. Emanuel said if this didn't make economic sense to GE and their bottom line, they would not have done it. Chicago's projected budget deficit for the next year is estimated to be between $500 and $700 million. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. Courtesy of Amy Goodman, host of The Great Democracy Now! Vermont is a land of proud firsts. The small New England state was the first to join the 13 colonies. Its constitution was the first to ban slavery. It was the first to establish the right to free education for all, the republic education. This week, Vermont is becoming the first state in the nation to offer single-payer health care, which eliminates the costly health insurance companies that many believe are the root cause of our spiraling health care costs. In a single-payer system, both private and public health care providers are allowed to operate, as they always have, but instead of the patient or the patient's private health insurance company paying the bill, the state does. It's basically Medicare for all. Just lower the age of eligibility to the day you were born. The state buying these health care services for the entire population can negotiate favorable rates and can eliminate the massive overhead that for-profit insurers impose. Vermont hired Harvard economist William Sow to come up with three alternatives to the current system. The single-payer system, Sow wrote, quote, will produce savings of 24.3% of total health expenditure between 2015 and 2024, end quote. An analysis by Don McCann, MD, of Physicians for a National Health Program pointed out that, quote, these plans would cover everyone without any increase in spending since the single-payer efficiencies would be enough to pay for those currently uninsured or underinsured. So this is very good news. Single-payer works, end quote. Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin explained his intention to sign the bill into law, saying, quote, here's our challenge. Our premiums go up 10, 15, 20% each year. This is true in the rest of the country as well. They are killing small business. They are killing middle-class Americans who have been kicked in the teeth over the last several years. What our plan will do is create a single pool, get the insurance company profits, the pharmaceutical company profits, the other folks that are mining the system to make a lot of money on the backs of our illnesses, and ensure that we're using those dollars to make Vermonters healthy, end quote. Sounds like something we ought to implement across the rest of the 49 states.
Exactly. All 49.
Yeah.
So, stories that we've kind of reported on here several times in the past, oh, 6 months or a year, about some of the working conditions at Foxconn, manufacturing plants over in China, and there was an explosion at one of their plants apparently last Friday. And electronics maker Foxconn Technology Group says the death toll in an explosion at its factory in southwestern China has risen from 2 to 3. And says Foxconn Technology Group is the contractor that manufactures Apple's iPhones and iPads, and it says Friday's blast in the western city of Chengdu killed 3 employees and injured 15. The Taiwanese company said production was suspended but did not respond to questions Monday about how supplies of iPads might be affected. Foxconn said the blast was caused by combustible dust in a workshop that polished products. It said operations and workshops that do similar work at its other factories in China would be suspended pending an investigation. Estimates by industry analysts of the impact on iPad production range from minimal to up to 2.8 million units in lost output. This is coming as global auto and electronics makers struggle with parts shortages caused by Japan's March 11 tsunami. And that disaster also emphasized the pitfalls for companies whose global sales depend on one or two factories. All of Apple's iPads are produced at Foxconn factories in Chengdu and Shenzhen near Hong Kong. Foxconn is a unit of Hanhe Precision Industry Company, and it's a leading contract manufacturer. And factories produce up to 80 to 90% of the world's notebook computers and 50 to 60% of mobile phones. And it also says that last year Foxconn scrambled to improve working conditions at its plants after a string of worker suicides, which we reported on that story earlier.
That's right.
Tom?
Hey, some of the states that drain their unemployment insurance funds are cutting the number of weeks that a laid-off worker can count on those benefits. Legislators are trying to limit tax increases for businesses to replenish the pool and are hoping the federal government keeps stepping in when the economy slumps. Michigan, Missouri, and Arkansas recently reduced the maximum number of weeks that the jobless can get state unemployment benefits, and Florida is on the verge of doing the same. Unemployment in those states ranges from 7.8% in Arkansas to 11.1% in Florida. The benefit cuts come as legislatures deal with the damage that the recession inflicted on state unemployment insurance programs. The sharp increase in the number of people who lost their jobs drained state reservoirs of money dedicated to paying out benefits. States usually provide up to 26 weeks of benefits to laid-off workers, but Michigan and Missouri have cut that to a maximum of 20 weeks, while Arkansas went down to 25 weeks. Benefits vary from state to state, but average about $300 a week, or about a third of the recipient's previous wages. In good economic times, most of the unemployed find a new job before their benefits expire. But in these times of such high unemployment, states are having to count on whatever extra help they can get from the federal government. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. Jane Slaughter wrote a great piece in Labor Notes about the overheated response from Boeing about an NLRB ruling, saying, when the NLRB told Boeing in April that it couldn't retaliate against workers who exercised their right to strike, Republican lawmakers in the Chamber of Commerce reacted as if Stalin himself had taken over the federal government. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley said, quote, "This goes against everything we know our American economy to be. This is an unbelievable attack on not just right-to-work states, but every state that's attempting to put their people to work," end quote. The airplane manufacturer took assembly work on the 787 Dreamliner away from union shops in Washington State, where Boeing had originally started and operated, shifting its production to right-to-work South Carolina, where executives had already crushed the machinist union. Boeing execs left no doubt about why they moved work, telling a reporter, quote, "We cannot afford to have a work stoppage, you know, every 3 years," end quote. International Association of Machinists spokesperson Connie Kelleher said she has 2 notebooks 7 inches high filled with newspaper articles and press releases where the company made clear its reason for moving work. The IAM brought the unfair labor practice charge to the National Labor Relations Board in March of 2010. After the machinists struck for 57 days in 2008 over the company's concession demands and out-of-control outsourcing, Boeing campaigned aggressively to keep it from happening again, demanding a no-strike pledge. Washington State coughed up $3 billion in subsidies to try to secure production of the Dreamliner, Boeing's next-generation jet. The machinists offered a 10-year no-strike pledge. But that wasn't good enough for Boeing, which chose to build in South Carolina instead. South Carolina officials, desperate for industry, laid out a $450 million welcome mat to entice the company. South Carolina's unionization rate, which is currently 4.6%, the sixth lowest in the country, was a big part of the sales pitch. Michael Goldberg, a labor law professor and longtime NLRB watcher, said the agency's ruling, despite the overheated rhetoric from the right, was, quote, well-established law, end quote, hardly a groundbreaking overreach. Corporations that create runaway shops to retaliate against workers who exercise their rights are committing an unfair labor practice, he said. What's unusual about the Boeing case is that, quote, usually employers are smart enough not to say what they're doing, end quote. The Boeing case is news because such cases usually involve small companies who don't have lawyers to tell managers to shut up. And that's the thing, you know, just as a brief side note, you know, this ruling doesn't curtail employer free speech, which has vast expanses for employers. It's oftentimes the difference between saying will or might move a shop that results in illegality. So Boeing basically shot itself in the foot with its own unsubtle approach to outsourcing.
Another side note on that story, Jason, 4.6% unionized workers in the state of South Carolina. And that's for all those people out there who say that there's unions are so powerful in this country and how they control everything, you know.
Yep,
it's absolutely the same thing with the United Mine Workers. When I did some research into that, you know, in West Virginia, what is it, like 2% of the miners are actually unionized in the state of West Virginia?
Yeah.
And that's utterly ridiculous. And they talk about all the power that the unions have and how they control all the politicians and things.
They're hamstringing our economy.
Yes.
An unbelievable attack on not just right-to-work states, but every state that's attempting to put their people to work, which might not include Washington here, according to the governor of South Carolina.
All right. On to another story here. This is out of Texas. Clad in vibrant pink, clerical workers at ExxonMobil's Baytown, Texas facility confronted the company's CEO, Rex Tillerson, and members of the board of directors at the company's shareholder meeting in Dallas on Wednesday. The workers, members of the United Steelworkers Local 13-2001, demanded to know why ExxonMobil, which recorded $30.5 billion in profits in 2010, is lavishing big rewards on top executives while refusing to give them raises and other benefits despite their increase in productivity. They also wanted to know why the company agreed to raises and bonuses for other Baytown, mostly male workers last year, but is offering their all-female unit nothing in bargaining, you know. Local 13-2001 and the company began negotiations March 1st for a new three-year agreement. The contract expired March 15th, but will continue in effect unless either party gives notice of a lockout or a strike. Baytown's refinery, chemical plant, and lab bargaining units received 3% yearly wage increases when their contract was negotiated in 2010. They also received a $2,500 signing bonus. Clerical worker Cheryl Webster said, "We wanted to know why ExxonMobil thinks we should be satisfied with nothing. ExxonMobil is trying to divide us from our steelworkers, brothers and sisters, and we won't take it lying down. As support staff in the Baytown refinery, chemical plant, lab, and main office building, the 41 women perform clerical and analytical work and handle functions like payroll, auditing, and in accounts receivable and payable. In addition to Baytown, Texas, clerical unit local members of the United Steelworkers ExxonMobil Council were present at the meeting from facilities in Beaumont, Texas, Baton Rouge, Chalmette, Cicero, Illinois, Torrance, California, and Billings, Montana. The clerical unit also received support from the District 13 Women of Steel chapter." Tom?
According to the Illinois Department of Employment Security, unemployment rates for several area counties dropped by a full percentage point in April. Two area counties saw even larger drops, with Ford County's rate dropping from 10.5% in March to 8.3% in April, and Iroquois County's rate fell from 9.8% to 8.4%. Vermilion, Douglas, Payette, DeWitt, and Edgar counties all fell by a full percentage point from March to April. In Champaign County, the rate fell to 7.2%, down from the 7.6% in March, and that was the lowest it's been since May of 2009, when the rate was 7.2% at that time. An estimated 7,643 Champaign County residents were out of work and looking for a job in April, while 97,999 residents were working. The statewide rate, not adjusted for seasonal variations, was 8.6%. Brown County in western Illinois had the lowest rate in the state with 4% unemployed, and Boone County in northern Illinois had the state's highest rate of unemployed at 12.8%. Among the 12 Illinois metropolitan areas, Bloomington-Normal had the lowest rate of 6.2%, and Rockford had the highest at 11.9%. Champaign-Urbana had the fourth lowest rate at 7.2%, and Danville had the fourth highest rate at 9.6%. Jason?
Thanks, Tom. Madison, Wisconsin's Dane County Judge Marion Sumi, who had previously blocked Wisconsin's controversial anti-union law from taking effect pending litigation, has now formally ruled that the manner in which the bill was passed violated the state's open meetings law and that the law itself is therefore not valid. She said, quote, "This case is the exemplar of values protected by the open meetings law, transparency in government, the right of citizens to participate in their government, and respect for the rule of law," end quote. She said this in her decision that WisPolitics reported on. She said further, quote, "It is not the court's business to determine whether the 2011 Wisconsin Act 10 is good public policy or bad public policy. That is the business of the legislature. It is the court's responsibility, however, to apply the rule of law to the facts before it," end quote. The matter revolves around a key conference committee used to advance the bill and to get around the state Senate Democrats' walkout from the state, and whether it violated the state's open meetings law by failing to give proper 24 hours notice. Therefore, it is a ruling on procedural grounds rather than on the substance of the bill itself, which here at Illinois World Labor Hour we've covered quite extensively. Thus, Republicans have always had an option if they wish to avoid this litigation. They could pass the bill again, giving full notice of all relevant hearings and legislative procedures. They've resisted this avenue, believing that to do so would be an admission of guilt on the open meetings law when they really concede no such thing. But in recent weeks, they've begun to talk up this very possibility as the court action dragged on. 2 months ago, Sumi blocked the law on procedural grounds, issuing a temporary restraining order on the grounds that the plaintiff, the Dane County District Attorney, had a likelihood of success in his complaint. The Walker administration then made multiple attempts to disregard the ruling and implement the law anyway before ultimately backing down in the face of repeated orders, including from Sumi herself. Bob?
Thanks, Jason. This is out of California, and this says, 3 days after statewide protests and lobbying by California teachers, Governor Jerry Brown earmarked an additional $3 billion for education. This victory is the result of many months of massive protests and lobbying across the state. In downtown Los Angeles on May 13th, about 3,000 teachers and their allies packed the square. Many had left their schools early, with administration support in some areas, to attend. Some political leaders and the media have barraged teachers and the public with cries that there is just not enough money to fully fund education. Over the past 3 years, 40,000 California teachers and support personnel have been cut. In some schools, 40 students are crammed into a classroom built to hold 25. But growing numbers of teachers are disputing the claim that our society is so poor there is no alternative to a life of unending cutbacks. United Teachers Los Angeles brought hundreds of signs to the rally demanding a solution for the budget crisis. Tax the rich to fund education and tax corporations to fund education. When Governor Brown released his revised 2012 budget and announced an additional $3 billion in new funding for California schools, UTLA demanded that the Los Angeles School District move to immediately rescind all layoff notices and begin to restore all other educational programs that have been slashed over the last 3 years. The teacher-led movement has also called on the state legislature to prevent expiration of taxes that we already pay, totaling $8.5 billion, and to support an additional 1% tax on the state's highest 1% of earners. Only 2 Republican votes in each house are needed to pass this tiny tax increase on the very rich, but not one Republican has supported it to date. The lobbying and protests continue. The message is clear. Victories can be won if a massive public movement is built to stop the cuts. All right. And how about if we go to some workers' independent news? We haven't played them for the last couple of weeks, but this is from Friday, and it talks about Michigan's GOP Senate approves more than $1 billion in education cuts. And I think after this we'll come back and listen to some Hightower news, because it looks like he's got a story about academic freedom for sale. So more on education here.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Michigan Senate has approved Republican Governor Rick Snyder's slashing of public education funding, more than $1 billion in cuts affecting all levels of Michigan public education. The cuts, though, are highly unpopular with the people of Michigan, according to polls. Michigan Education Association spokesman Doug Pratt says the Republican action is not the last word on public education funding in Michigan.
It's not really a done deal until the voters have a chance to react, and they're going to react. Polling shows that the public is incensed about this, and they're going to make their voices heard in November of 2012, if not sooner. The governor's approval rating has gone through the floor. The governor has said repeatedly that that's not something he's worried about. The lawmakers who have to run for re-election in November of 2012 are going to start to care very much.
A couple of polls released this week shows the Republican governors in Wisconsin and Ohio losing substantially in a re-vote. Jesse Russell reports.
While that isn't likely to become a reality anytime soon in Ohio, Wisconsin has looser recall laws, and come January, a signature campaign is set to launch. According to public policy polling, when voters were asked if they would support a recall election for Governor Scott Walker, 50% said they would. That's a slight uptick since the last poll by the organization. It can be tied mostly to Walker's collective bargaining rights stripping legislation, also known as Act 10. If that election were held today, the best possible candidate for Democrats would be former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, who beats Walker with a spread of 52-42. The situation is worse for Ohio Governor John Kasich. Only 33% approve of the job he's doing. In a rematch with former Governor Ted Strickland, Kasich would be crushed by 59-34%. Kasich's fall with voters can be mostly tied to SB 5, which, like Wisconsin's Act 10, strips most collective bargaining rights from state employees. 55% of those polled say they'll vote to repeal the bill if it makes it to referendum in November. Additionally, 45% said they'd be willing to pass a constitutional amendment protecting collective bargaining rights in the state.
On Thursday, Wisconsin Judge Marianne Sumi issued a permanent injunction against Walker's collective bargaining bill. The Wisconsin Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on that law June 6th. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Billionaires are different from you and me. For obvious reasons, including the fact that they buy much pricier baubles than we do. A sleek car costing $100,000? Well, that's just an impulse purchase. A few million bucks for a Matisse original? Go ahead, it'll liven up the hallway. How about throwing a fat wad of cash at a university to get an academic chair named for you? Sure, it's all part of living in billionaire land. Then there are megalomaniacal mega-billionaires like the Koch brothers. Using money from their industrial conglomerate, their foundation, and their personal fortunes, these two far-out laissez-faire extremists are literally buying public policy. Their purchases of everything from politicians to the Tea Party help them push the privatization of all things public and the elimination of pesky regulations and taxes that crimp their style. To advance their plutocratic cause, Brother Charles has gone on a shopping spree for an invaluable bauble that most of us didn't even know was for sale. Academic freedom. And it's surprisingly cheap. For only $1.5 million, Koch bought a big chunk of the economics department of Florida State University. His donation gives him control of a new academic program at this public institution to indoctrinate students in his self-serving political theories. The billionaire gets to screen all applicants, veto any he deems insufficiently ideological, and sign off on all hires. Also, the department head must submit yearly reports to Koch about the faculty's speeches, publications, and classes, and he evaluates the faculty based on objectives that he sets. This is Jim Hightower saying, Charles has made similar purchases of academic freedom at two other state universities, Clemson and West Virginia. Now just imagine the screams of outrage that you and I would be hearing from the Kochs if a labor union was doing this.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And we're back, and you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming at weft.org, and this is the Illinois World Labor Hour, and we've come to that time in the program where it's time for Tom's poem. This is the Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week from his book Cries for Justice is entitled Labor Builds Dreams.
Labor can build America to the dream that was meant to be if workers close the plantations down and make us the land of the free. Labor has built the structures that have stood since our nation was born. Workers have cried and bled and died to bring us a bright shining morn. 'Twas labor that built the highways that brought us together as one. From coast to coast and north to south, what magnificent jobs they've done. Yet laborers are victims now of the big brothers straight from hell, violated and spied upon even in our homes where we dwell. Some sneaky snakes in Washington connive to bring slavery back. With benefits and wages cut, the deck against labor is stacked. 'Twas labor built the buildings where the most evil rulers now rule, the ones who stole their offices but never have handled a tool. In this 21st century, this time of the neocon lie, it's time to stand up against them and show them that labor won't die. It's time for unions to be strong, to protect this land that they built. Gene Debs, Joe Hill, or Mother Jones would not let our liberties wilt. Laborers, gather together and stand up against them as one. Show each Judas in Washington our unions will never be done. Labor Builds Dreams was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 17, 2006 and was brought to you live today, May 28, 2011, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Excellent poem there, Tom. I had a teacher in seventh grade who accused all of her students of being sneaky snakes.
So. First heard the term, but that's been a lot of years ago.
It was many years ago. I hadn't remembered that for about 40-some years. So, anyway, I think we got a couple public service announcements for you here.
Yeah, the poll was great, Tom.
Excellent, yeah.
Celebrate 30 years of community radio on Saturday, June 11th from 2 to 6 p.m. at a wine tasting benefit for WEFT, hosted by Bouvon's Wine Bar at the Corkscrew, 203 North Vine Street in Urbana. Wines from around the world will be served and available for purchase on the day of the tasting. Appetizers will be provided by the Black Dog Smoke and Ale House. There will be a silent auction including collector's wines and other items. That's a celebration benefit for WEFT on Saturday, June 11, from 2 to 6 p.m., hosted by Bouvon's Wine Bar at the Corkscrew in Urbana. The donation is $10 at the door. Bob?
All right, we also have another announcement. The second quarter 2011 WEFT Associates meeting is going to go on this Wednesday night, June 1st, from 7 to 9 p.m., and that happens at the Urbana Civic Center. That's at 108 East Water Street in Urbana. The parking lot is adjacent to the Urbana Civic Center, and CUMTD has four evening routes to Lincoln Square Bus Shelter, so you can take the green, the gray, or the silver, or the Urbana Link bus to get there. And if you have questions, you can email the Associates Executive Committee at weftx@list.weft.org. And once again, you're all welcome and invited to come attend the Associates meeting. You get to meet some of us airshifters. A lot of us typically attend those meetings. You can see us in action as we discuss the workings of the station and what we're planning on doing and whatnot. It's an interesting meeting always. And once again, that's going on Wednesday, June 1st, 2011, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Urbana Civic Center. And we should also mention that every Sunday you can catch Laborers View TV, hosted by one of our co-hosts, David Johnson, and a friend of the show, Jim Iman. That's cable channel 6, Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. And Jason has a
Yes, and please be sure to listen also to another friend of the program, Neil Parthen's excellent Not Another Sports Show on WRFU 104.5 FM every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. I was actually on last week, and Neil just does a great job taking an often left and alternative perspective on sports, so be sure to tune in there, too.
Excellent show, yes. And we're going to go to a slight short musical break here, and I'm inspired by Eunice Buckner Boone this morning. She played a couple tracks from Sweet Honey in the Rock, and she actually sang a little bit of this song. And Eunice, she got a sweet voice, but we're going to listen to Sweet Honey in the Rock doing Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round. Sweet Honey in the Rock, and Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around. And we're back. You are listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour here at WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming at weft.org. And Jason's going to take a look back at Memorial Day in relation to some labor history events.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I figured this weekend when we celebrate Memorial Day, it's a holiday of remembrance for Americans to reflect upon and celebrate the contributions of the many soldiers who have served throughout the years in America's armed forces. But there are events in American labor history well worth remembering, too. It also happened to have occurred at the end of May, and with these two in particular that I'll discuss, also not accidentally occurred within days of each other, part of this broader anti-union, violent anti-union, anti-worker campaign that occurred in 1937. These two events, the so-called Battle of the Overpass at Ford's massive River Rouge complex in Dearborn outside Detroit, occurred on May 26, 1937, and the Memorial Day massacre just a few days later in Chicago on May 30th. Worth remembering in their own right as key and dramatic and violent, deadly occurrences that reveal the tribulations and the horrors and struggles that working people in America had faced and endured and overcame. That these pivotal events are, I think, so easily swept into the memory hole of mainstream media, easy to blur beneath the veneer of the public displays of patriotism, illustrates how class-based issues, class-conscious memory, receive short shrift in our society at best and are treated with disrespect or indifference at times at worst. For the first incident, the Battle of the Overpass, really this gooning of UAW organizers, had occurred when UAW, after successfully organizing at GM, had planned a leaflet campaign entitled Unionism, Not Fordism, at the pedestrian overpass at the River Rouge complex, demanding an $8 six-hour day for workers instead of the $6 eight-hour day that was then in place. The campaign was planned to be at shift change time, expecting some 9,000 workers entering and exiting the plant right there. At around 2 p.m., several UAW organizers, including Walter Reuther and Richard Frankenstein, who had actually later ran for mayor of Detroit and very nearly won, were asked by a Detroit news photographer, James E. Scotty Kilpatrick, to pose for a picture on the overpass with the Ford sign in the background. While they were posing, men from Ford's service department, which was not there to fix cars but rather fix anyone interested in organizing a union, which worked under the direction of Harry Bennett, came from behind and began to beat them. The number of attackers disputed, but some say it may have been as many as 40. Frankenstein had his jacket pulled over his head and was kicked and punched repeatedly. Walter Reuther described some of the benevolent treatment from the Ford Service Department that he received, saying, quote, seven times they raised me off the concrete and slammed me down on it. They pinned my arms, and I was punched and kicked and dragged by my feet to the stairway, thrown down the first flight of steps, picked up, slammed down on the platform, and kicked down the second flight. On the ground, they beat me and kicked me some more, end quote. One union organizer, Richard Merriweather, suffered a broken back as a result of a beating he received. The group then beat some of the beret-wearing women who had arrived to pass out leaflets, along with some reporters and photographers, while Dearborn police at the scene largely ignored the violence. The mob also attempted to destroy photographic plates, but the Detroit news photographer hid the photographic plates under the back seat of his car and surrendered useless plates he had on his front seat. News and photos of the brutal attack made headlines in newspapers across the country. And Kilpatrick's photos in particular inspired the Pulitzer Committee to institute a prize for photography. Within a few days of the severe and violent attack by the Ford Service Department goons on the UAW organizers, another larger, even more violent attack on working people occurred on May 30th in Chicago. Coming on the heels of the CIO's recent successes in early 1937, first in Flint with the sit-down strike bringing the national UAW to GM, and building upon this, the signing of a contract between the Steelworkers Organizing Committee of the CIO and U.S. Steel on March 37th, which this particular contract, without a strike, granted a 10% wage increase, 40-hour work week, and time and a half for overtime for steelworkers. Building upon this, the steelworkers sought to unionize the brutally anti-union so-called little steel companies, which were Republic, Bethlehem, Inland, Jones and Laughlin, and Youngstown Sheet and Tube. Important to keep in mind, they were only little, really, in relation to U.S. Steel, which, for the five and other little steel companies, employed about 200,000 people. Steelworkers Organizing Committee on May 26 started an organizing drive, or really an organizing strike, against Little Steel, Youngstown Sheet and Tube, and Inland plants in East Chicago, Indiana, effectively shutting them down with especially strong support from Mexican-American steelworkers striking. Republic had conducted heavy strike preparations, spending nearly $50,000 on new equipment such as clubs, nightsticks, pistols, rifles, tear gas, and gas guns for the private police force. Little Steele also drummed local anti-unionism up through so-called citizens alliances that it created, while the press pilloried SWOC, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, and the CIO as coercive, dictatorial, and radical, wetting the public with inaccurate imagery to demonize peaceful and legal workers' collective activity. Democratic politicians, meanwhile, in three key areas for industry, unionization, and politics, Mayor Edward Kelly of Chicago, Governor Martin Daley of Ohio, and Governor George Earl Jr. of Pennsylvania used their governments against the CIO, especially, in this case, the Chicago police, and eventually turned against the CIO that had supported them politically. On Memorial Day, over 1,000 peaceful protesters headed to the main gate of Republic Steel in Chicago's south side. Peaceful and mainly families, Southern European immigrants, also African Americans and Mexican Americans, gathered north of the gate and were faced by 200 police officers who had refused their request to set up a police picket line, despite Mayor Kelly's promises that the police would allow this. After a few strikers had thrown rocks at police, after a brief discussion, cops opened fire, killing 10, injuring over 100 by shooting over 30, including three children, and beating the fleeing crowd mercilessly with clubs and axe handles, hospitalizing another 28. Nearly all of those shot were struck with gunfire in the back. Yet headlines in local papers blared, quote, "Reds riot at steel mill," end quote, and a coroner's jury called the killings, quote, "justifiable homicide," end quote.
Sounds like cold-blooded murder to me.
Absolutely. And the violence didn't end there. It precipitated more extreme violence, where in June of 1937 it brought 8 more strikers' deaths, 160 serious injuries, and thousands more who were tear-gassed, arrested, and harassed. In Monroe, Michigan, for example, an anti-union crowd severely beat African-American steelworkers organizer Leonidas McDonald. Afterward, Republic Steel's private police gassed union picketers and burned down the SWOC headquarters in Monroe. In Youngstown, Ohio, 2 strikers were shot and 42 were injured. The Ohio National Guard, meanwhile, sent by Governor Daley, jailed all the union organizers and hundreds of union members. Steelworkers Organizing Committee head called, who was Philip Murray at the time, called on Franklin Delano Roosevelt to aid steelworkers, and the CIO had shown FDR strong support in the 36 elections. Roosevelt, however, dubbed the strike, quote, "a real headache," and said derisively, quote, "the majority of the people are saying just one thing, a plague on both your houses," end quote. And this precipitated an angry response from CIO President United Mine Workers President John L. Lewis, who retorted, quote, "It ill behooves one who has supped at labor's table and who has been sheltered in labor's house to curse with equal fervor and fine impartiality both labor and its adversaries when they become locked in deadly embrace." So in closing, I think there are a few lessons that we should glean from this here in Memorial Day weekend. One, especially from these events, that time and again, violence has been a reality for workers and unions when they show even modest gains. Violence and preparations for it were standard fare for businesses, as these actions and subsequent investigations from the La Follette Committee in the late 1930s revealed in stunning detail. Also, for all the legal and political and legislative gains at the federal, state, and local levels in the mid-1930s, workers and organized labor were continually let down by the very people whom they elected, especially had supported in the 1936 elections. Keep in mind, too, especially when this occurred in May of 1937, that these two violent incidents and their aftermath in Dearborn and in Chicago occurred after the Supreme Court had upheld the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Act, which businesses had uniformly challenged, which was passed in 1935. This was upheld by the Supreme Court on April 12th of 1937, ironically in the National Labor Relations Board versus Jones and Laughlin Steel Company case. This was one of the so-called Little Steel, bitterly anti-union companies. It's been struggle, organizing, and persistence in remembering all that working people have endured and gained and lost in the constant ebbs and flows with employers and the state that has produced what modest gains working people have ever made. As the great organizer for emancipation, Frederick Douglass, said on August 3, 1857, in his West India Emancipation Address, quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and never will. Remember those workers who in the past have made demands for improvements in legal protection, however peacefully, only to be met with weapons of violence, rhetoric of demonization, forces of repression, and moods of indifference and callousness. Be sure to remember those working people who have given so much, with some making the ultimate sacrifice of paying for progress with their lives, this and every Memorial Day."
Thanks, Jason. Excellent. Excellent stuff.
Absolutely.
We're going to go to a short musical break here, something from Duke Robillard. Duke is going to be in town here coming up June 24th, 25th, actually, at the Urbana Blues Brews and Barbecue. head on out there. It's a great free blues fest, although I think they ask for a few dollar donation for I think a good portion of that goes to Eastern Illinois Food Bank, if I recall. But anyway, Duke Robillard will be in town here June 25th. That's a stellar lineup they got there this year. All kinds of great blues guitarists, Coco Montoya, Jimmy Thackeray, Chris Duarte, John Primer, and Duke Robillard, and Duke singing a little song about working hard for his uncle.
Best people, I treat everybody right. While the rich keep getting richer, I'm barely keeping up the fight. They got to build them some more weapons, put more debris up there in space. While I'm working hard for my uncle, and I can hardly keep the pace. They're gonna take all my possession. Now they are taxing all my pay. I didn't know what I was doing. They don't believe a word I say. Lord, I'm just trying to make a living. The only way that I know how. While corporations are hiding millions, politicians breaking every working for my uncle, just like a bullet pulled the mound. By having fun, people. Ain't nothing left for buying clothes. I can't buy my baby diamonds or fancy stockings for her toes. How will I keep my baby happy? How will I keep her looking hot? This working hard for my uncle is taking everything I got. I'm working hard for my uncle. Lord, and it's got me on the spot. Lord, it's got me on the spot. I'm working hard. Working hard. Lord, I'm working hard.
And that is Duke Robillard working hard for his uncle. And Duke will be in town June 25th as part of the Urbana Blues Brews and Barbecue. And Friday night's a good night of music out there as well. Come out. WEFT will have our tent out there. And we'll be meeting and greeting some folks and stuff. It plans to be a really fun time. So come on out and see us and see some great music. So anyway, Jason has some comments and some thoughts and some facts involving what Paul Muth started discussing earlier this morning on the News from Neptune show about the Illinois House passing a law, passing a bill that looks like it wants to pretty much abolish workman's comp in the state of Illinois, at least in its existing structure. So, Jason?
Right. That's exactly it. And there seems to be some debate among the politicians of whether or not this is just a pressure tactic or whether or not this is a bill to eliminate. But either way, you know, this is nothing good for working people. Where the House had passed this by a vote of 65-48. In fact, its main sponsor was a Democrat from Marion. And this is John Bradley, who sponsored this and looking to do this. That basically, in this form, would eliminate workers' compensation as we know it. It would end up steering, if this ends up going through, which is, as we were talking about off air, is very much in question because the Senate is sitting on a different bill that would eliminate business payments into the workers' comp system by like 30%, and with the idea of saving $500 million over some period of time. But that if this House version were to go through, what we would have is workers' compensation claims changing in some fundamental ways. One is that these would go through a court system, which would
the circuit court
which
system,
which is already tremendously overloaded.
Right, right. It says that 50,000 cases
in Illinois,
would be annually would be handled by the overburdened circuit court system.
Yeah. I mean, how would they possibly? It's as if this is meant not to process.
Exactly.
And it's also, I think, designed with the idea of acting as a form of prior restraint for people because, one, the burden would then be on workers in order to prove basically the fault for the injuries, which is going to require lawyers, and plenty of people simply can't afford this. And that's the other element of this as well. I think this is meant to act as a kind of prior restraint against these claims as a whole because it just makes it individualized and therefore much more difficult for people to afford this. It's just all I could think of, especially earlier with Tom's story about the way in which unemployment benefits are being rolled back, and especially with Hightower and talking about the way in which these uber rich operate. It's just galling the way in which these crises are and the alleged solutions for them are coming back onto working people, especially for here, the most needy and often most vulnerable people in our society who have been injured.
Yes.
Who cannot work in some form, if at all, are the ones who are basically not even being asked, but being told to give in this system. It's just ludicrous.
I got a quote here. It says, even the bill's sponsor, State Representative John Bradley, Democrat of Marion, acknowledged that blowing up the system would not be an ideal solution, but frustrations with negotiation and the ills of the current system forced the state to consider this option. You know, it's just ridiculous. It's like what they did up there in...
It's like saying, well, I kicked him because he might have kicked me. You never know.
Yeah. It's like what they're doing up there in Michigan with their emergency bill or whatnot, taking over the whole Traverse City, Michigan. Is that where that was occurring? They basically saying the elected officials have no power. We're appointing somebody to manage your city now and to make all contracts, make all decisions. And so we don't care whether you elected city council members, school board members. Basically, they said those people had no rights anymore. All they could do was basically call the meeting to order and read the minutes or something like that. And the appointed official is now going to make all decisions for us. You know,
appointed, not elected.
Right, exactly. And they're superseding our elected officials in some instances. You know, that's in Michigan, of course, in Traverse City. But this is similar kind of, so you can see the writing on the wall here, you know, in Illinois.
Definitely. I think it's a good comparison, and I also think that part of that element that's so common in that is the way in which fundamental democratic principles, as far as in representation, access to justice in each of these are eliminated. And here, I mean, what justice are people possibly going to get where if you're looking at this, if this were to go through, a wholesale elimination of a system that has been set up to try to, in some ways, help and provide something for people.
And it has been primarily successful in doing so.
To a good degree, even with some warts and flaws, it's certainly far better than nothing and has done plenty for people who have been on it. What recourse are they going to get in the court system, especially as we talk about how gummed up things already are? This is ridiculous.
Well, like the story I read earlier, you know, ExxonMobil had $30.5 billion in profits last year. You know, how's a little person who was injured on the job going to fight in courts against somebody like that, you know?